morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Stephen Vladek for the appellants. This appeal presents a single legal question with far-reaching consequences: whether the government's acceptance and use of an overhauled product necessarily establishes that a maintenance contractor conformed to specifications under Boyle. The answer is, and ought to be, no. As this Court has repeatedly held, Boyle shields contractors from state tort law only when they do what the government told them to do. Here, appellants adduced detailed expert evidence identifying at least three respects in which Standard Aero's maintenance did not conform to the government's specifications. Appellant's experts further documented how those failures caused the engine to fail and the aircraft to crash. This evidence, which the district court did not discredit, created genuine questions of material fact as to both conformance and causation. Indeed, no decision of this court has ever treated acceptance and use as conclusive in the face of specific evidence of nonconformance, and for good reason. The rule wrongly adopted by the district court in this case would immunize every maintenance contractor the moment the government retakes possession of a component, foreclosing liability, even where, as here, undetected nonconformance is what caused the harm. That result would not only leave tort victims without a remedy, it would shift the cost of verifying conformance onto the government.
Let's look at the evidence that you're talking about. It seems to me that at least one of your principal alleged evidence, or at least arguments that this was not properly maintained, has to deal with basically whether there was, see if I can say this word, axis symmetry in the placement of the rotor blades. Is that the argument, or the factual argument that's principally being made, that that is what caused this crash?
So two things together, Judge Southwick. That's part of it. And if I might refer Your Honors to page 13 of our opening brief, there's a picture that I think you might find useful. The two pieces that fit together here, Judge Southwick, are first the, in our view, mismachining of the blade land diameters combined with, and it took me some time to get this word right too, the non-axis symmetric installation.
Okay, so you are talking about the length of the blades perhaps being, not perhaps, you are arguing that there's evidence that they were too long.
And indeed, just to be very clear about that, Judge Southwick, the tolerance required by the contract, which we don't dispute, was within 0.02 of an inch. Some of the measurements were upwards of 0.074 of an inch off, so 37 times out of specifications. And the reason why I think the picture on page 13 is so informative is because what you see in that picture, Judge Southwick, is you see something that should not be there. You see isolated patches of what the experts call blade rub, when if the blade lands were machined correctly, if the assembly was installed axisymmetrically, it would be uniform throughout the inside of the compressor.
Well, but I thought that's a question I have about the argument. It seems to me if it's rubbing on this outer shell around the blades are too long, and they probably have not been properly whatever machined. So it wasn't a constant sort of groove being created on this outer core itself show impropriety on the maintenance?
So if I might, 2 points on that, Judge Southwick. The first is, it's not just the isolated patches of blade rub. It's the lathing that was still visible that should have been worn away. And so our experts testified in the district court that both of those together were evidence of both of those
said rub. It's some sort of coating that was left.
That's right.
After the maintenance
I believe
was done,
it's an aluminum
rubbed
coating
away.
That's right.
But it's not an indication that the blades were too long.
Well, I think it was both, Judge Southwick. And so there are two different things going on here. That it's possible, for example, that if the blade land diameters had been too long, but the case was installed axisymmetrically, the proper way, that you would have never seen the kind of oscillations that our experts documented. Again, I think but the second point I wanted to make to Your Honor's question is, this kind of fact dispute is exactly where
we
want
to know what the dispute is, because in part there's no dispute if, in fact, what you're trying to show wouldn't support the ultimate causation. And so I'm trying to understand whether you're saying that the core itself was not properly installed and it was not centered. How about I use that? And so, that the blades were too long, or does the whole thing come down to you need evidence to show that the core unit was axisymmetric?
So we have both, exercise. Right? And so it's both together, Judge Southwick, right?
That you need is to show both? Does it need to be evidence of both?
I think to back up a second on the engineering here, I think with if all we had were the blade land diameters, I'm not sure you ever would have had the engine failure. And so I'm not sure we'd be here at all because there wouldn't have been an accident. I don't think we need both under Boyle, Judge Southwick. I think both is why this accident happened, that you had both.
Well, the dispute needs to be material. That's what I'm working at right now. Yes. What is material about each of those yes. two pieces?
So what's material about the blade land diameters is that the mismachining of the blade land diameters led for the rotors to not actually cover the full diameter of the inside of the compressor case the way they were supposed to. And what's material about the non-axisymmetric installation of the entire assembly was that it was tilted, was that it was not rotating symmetrically, which produced, as Dr. Spakovsky testified below, what's known as rotor whirl instability. Now, Judge Southwick, it's possible you could have had rotor whirl instability, which is our expert's theory of causation of the crash, with just one of those. The point here is that we have expert evidence as to both. And I think that's why we believe summary judgment was inappropriate in the district court.
But the plane operated for quite a while after this reconstruction, or whatever you want to call it. So why all of a sudden did it crash?
Sure. So, Judge Clement, there's evidence in the record that actually the degrading performance of the number one engine became apparent at least in the digital flight data recorder data as early as the fifth flight after the compressor was installed. That's not a lot of time. I mean, just to put this into context, Your Honor, we have in our reply brief, and I'll refer you to page 13 of our reply brief, the prior operational cycle of this very same compressor between its last overhaul and when it was maintained in this case was 2,843 hours. So the 35.4 hours in this case was 1.2% of the prior operational cycle. It wasn't even 18% of what Standard Aero warranted as the performance time for the compressor. And so, Judge Clement, the question is, for Boyle purposes, is that enough time to really believe that the government was aware of the problem? Is that enough time to really transfer the liability that we believe Standard Aero has to the government because Standard Aero was only doing what the government told it to do? There's no evidence in the record that the government was aware of the problem. The DFDR data that I referred Your Honor to wasn't apparent until after the crash. And so on that record, our submission is not necessarily that we would have been entitled to summary judgment. It's just that there's a genuine question of fact as to conformance that should have warranted against summary judgment in the district court.
So no summary judgment.
That's all we're here on. I mean, I think what's strange about this case from my perspective, Your Honors, is that the district court, Judge Ezra, in his opinion, specifically noted that there is competing views of experts. He denied Standard Aero's multiple requests to exclude our experts under Daubert, and he nevertheless granted summary judgment based on his conclusion that the government's acceptance and use was enough. Judge Clement, you know, I think my prior response to Your Honor's question suggests why we don't think that's sufficient. And if I might go back to this court's case law on this point, I mean, there's a bit of a dispute in the briefs over what this court has held. We're not asking this court to do anything new. We think that this follows from this court's Boyle cases, especially, for example, Smith versus Xerox. So we quote extensively from Smith versus Xerox in our briefs, where this court said, if you'll forgive me for quoting in a bit of detail, quote, in the absence of any evidence adduced by Smith, the plaintiff in that case, tending to show that the Viper, the product, had a manufacturing defect, and in the light of the government's acceptance and extended use of the Viper, and the agent's testimony that all units were inspected and tested, we find that the district court properly granted summary judgment in favor of Xerox. The very next paragraph, and by the way, Your Honors, that's 866 F second at 139.
Counsel, let me ask you, regarding this certificate of conformance, what weight should we give that, and what's your best case? I assume you're going to suggest to us, as you have in your brief, that we should not place a lot of gravity when deciding under the Boyle test. What's your best case that suggests that we can discount the certificate of acceptance?
Sure. So, I mean, I think, I'm not sure if Your Honor is going to love this answer, but our best case is the Miller case from the Connecticut Supreme Court, which, of course, is not binding on this court, but we think it's strongly probative. And Judge Engelhardt, as we note in our opening brief, in Miller, and I realize there are two Millers here, in the Connecticut version of Miller, The Connecticut Supreme Court spoke at some length, Judge Engelhardt, about why, even after there was a DD-250 in that case, the government had taken back possession of the, and said, sometimes, especially in airplane crash cases, the Connecticut Supreme Court says, it's entirely possible that the government will have no reason to suspect at the time of repossession that there's a problem, and that the problem won't manifest itself until down the line. That's our best case, and I think our brief explains in pretty strong detail why it's on all fours here. If I might say, I'm sorry, Judge Talbot.
Well, I know you want to talk about something, but let's see if I can direct you to a slightly different location for a
Please.
Moment. The response to some of what you said in the brief from opposing counsel, plaintiffs fail to articulate or cite any evidence of a specific deviation from the WP-150 or 158 that would have resulted in the blade roll. Basically, they're relying first on a shop order, I think it was, that showed the specifications were exactly met. You have an answer to that, which is perhaps those were done, just repeating what the specifications were. But if, in fact, there's evidence that the specifications that were measured, actually measured and not just restated in the shop order, and that they met those specifications at that time, what do you say to this argument from opposing counsel that you have to show something else failed to meet specifications before it can be the basis of your lawsuit?
So I think two things are getting conflated in that argument, Judge Southwick, and I'd like to try to pull them apart. One is the conformance question under Boyle, and one is the causation question. And I think that actually Your Honor's question implicates those in slightly different respects. So on the conformance point, yes, if Standard Aero had produced in the district court direct evidence that it had actually measured the blade land diameters at the time of machining, if it had produced evidence that it had tested it, as paragraph 1.4.3 of the performance work standards required it to test it, then I think we would have had a harder time showing that our evidence was sufficient to defeat summary judgment on conformance. But there was none of that evidence in the district.
Would you find a genuine dispute material fact of whether those measurements actually were measurements?
Yes. We believe there's a genuine issue of fact as to whether those measurements were actually taken by Standard Aero. And we believe that material question of fact is further demonstrated by the contrary measurements of our experts. And by the deposition testimony of Standard Aero's own witness, Mr. Art Sepulveda, who testified that the shop order was not prepared after the maintenance was completed.
My understanding from the response brief to that is that he was talking generally about a variety of shop orders and didn't identify this one.
Either way, Judge Southwick. And so again, if the question
is... Correct. So he or she didn't actually say that this shop order did not reflect actual measurements.
But he did... So
but it was in a category that might have included...
I guess, I don't think it will help us to sort of quibble over how we characterize Mr. Sepulveda's testimony. The relevant point is that testimony, at least I think, further highlights the question of fact as to whether those measurements were contemporaneous, as to whether they were post-maintenance.
But you do agree if they were, in fact, measurements taken, you do need to show some other non-conformity.
And I think the non-axis symmetric rotor assembly is it, Judge Southwick. And if I might, it's worth noting that for everything Standard Aero says in its response brief, it actually has no response to the isolated patches of blade rub. It never responds to the picture on page 13.
Well, how does that get measured? I mean, I don't know if any of these WP numbered documents actually have something that would show how you place a rotor assembly so that it is axis symmetric. Is there a measurement that in some way would have reflected that in conformance or non-conformance and therefore come from that?
There is, and it's WP, just to be clear, Judge Southwick, it's WP-150 and WP-158. Those are the two work packets together that required Standard Aero to reinstall the entire assembly in a manner that was axis symmetric. And we have direct evidence, not just after-the-fact evidence, from our experts because of the blade rub that's pictured on page 13, because of the lathing that is still present, was still present on the inside of the compressor case. And just one more point on this, Your Honors. Standard Aero makes a lot out of how the crash would have deformed the physical evidence of nonconformance. Here's an example to the contrary. There's no way that those particular evidentiary points, the isolated patches of blade rub, the continued presence of the aluminum lathing, could have been caused by the crash. Those could only have happened while the engine was in operation, while the rotor assembly was operating. So again, it goes back to where we started, which is a genuine issue of material fact on the conformance question, because even if you take the evidence as a trier of fact might, as suggesting that Standard Aero did measure the blade land diameters correctly, you still have the non-axisymmetric assembly installation, which by itself, Judge Southwick, according to Dr. Spakovsky, our expert, would have been enough to cause the same rotor whirl instability, would have been enough to cause the same engine problems that directly led to the crash.
That engine stopped, so it caused the crash. So it would be in the same condition with respect to the blades and the symmetry if it crashed without turning off.
That was Mr. Cardin's testimony, Judge Clement. If I might, there's a bit of, I think, talking past each other in the briefs on this point. There were parts of the compressor assembly that were damaged by the physical deformities caused by the crash, which is why Mr. Cardin based his measurements on those parts of the assembly, those parts of the compressor that were not physically deformed, that did not show the same physical deformations. And there's no explanation, let alone one that would be sufficient to justify summary judgment from Standard Aero about how you could have had those same data points, the isolated patches of blade rub, the presence of the lathing, had the maintenance conformed to the relevant specifications, specifically Judge Southwick to WP 150 and 158. Your Honor, I understand that it might seem from the briefs like we're asking this court to hold that we're right on conformance and causation. And I just want to stress one last time, that's not the question on appeal. The question on appeal is simply whether Judge Ezra erred by granting summary judgment to Standard Aero when he did not discredit the plaintiff's evidence, when he held that the experts had different views on what the answers were, and when the plaintiffs actually had adduced significant, detailed evidence, both of nonconformance and of how the nonconformance caused the accident.
All right, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Jeff Oldham on behalf of the Appellees, which I'll refer to as Standard Aero. This case is at the heart of why the government contractor defense exists, which is to protect the government's discretionary acts when it chooses to hire military contractors to carry out the details of its work. There's no question on appeal that the military issued specific protocols on how Standard Aero was to do its work. And the government's acceptance and use of Standard Aero's work and finished product was nothing like a rubber stamp. There was an ongoing process of close government oversight and monitoring and then acceptance that lasted months, including real-time on-site monitoring and audits, post-work inspections, repeated testing, and other oversights. And then the government used that compressor extensively for 15 months. And that went well beyond flight hours.
Monitoring include before, as I understand it, what your client does is it's encased. It's delivered to the government or to the Air Force or whatever agency encased. So the work that's done cannot be viewed once the product leaves your client. Is that correct?
That's not correct, Your Honor. That's talking about a later stage in the process. Okay. And I think it'd be really helpful if I could explain.
So the monitoring goes to the very things that the experts are talking about?
That's correct. The testimony talks about two layers of oversight before you get to the inspection that plaintiffs talk about that it's in a case. The testimony was that first, the DCMA agents for the government were stationed at the facility while the work was going on, monitoring the work that was happening. Second, as part of that on-site, they would do what's called quality audits or process audits. And the testimony was that there were 24 to 28 audits specifically, quote, in 2016 for the T56 compressor. That's at ROA pages 2987. Those audits are robust. What happened on those audits was that the testimony was DCMA agents would walk the shop, witness the work, and specifically their goal was to, quote, ensure that Standard Aero was complying with the requirements of how the government requested the work to be performed. That's it. 2962 of the Record on Appeal, agents would literally walk the floor and stop work happening to ensure that the manuals were out and being followed. And all of that, to your question, Judge Engelhardt, was when it was disassembled throughout the entire process. Then after those two phases, I'm sorry, Stop, did you have a question?
Well, I didn't decide to let you finish your sentence, but it does seem to me that the evidence, as I understood from the briefs anyway, doesn't directly support that any of those reviews led to examining whether the measurements we're talking about now and the axisymmetry of this particular problematic part of the engine was done. I mean, they're there, they're doing important work, but as far as whether they would have checked the measurements that we're talking about here that were perhaps not so consistent with requirements, I don't think the evidence shows that. Tell me if I'm missing where it does.
Well, I think that the evidence of acceptance and use is robust, and we have these processes. I think if the question that the court's going to ask is whether this particular step, we have eyewitness facts that this one thing was done, I think the Boyle Doctrine would come to an end, because you're never going to have that kind of evidence, and the acceptance and use doctrine would come to an end. Under this court has accepted the acceptance and use doctrine, and as part of that, and as part of looking at conformance, the question is whether the contractor conformed to the precise specifications that were given. And in this case, in the acceptance and use doctrine, you have direct evidence of conformance, because you have the government saying through its close monitoring, close oversight, and acceptance that the government itself says that there was conformance with every step of the process. Now, in terms of, I think plaintiffs have sometimes talked about this as being a latent defect, because there could have been a step missed, or there could have been some detail that was overlooked. And there's other Boyle prongs that are disputed in other cases that could address that. For example,
if we were to disagree with you and find that, as your opponent suggests, that this is a genuine dispute more suited for a jury, is the Boyle test something that a jury can be instructed on? Is there case law that indicates that the Boyle test could be a jury question?
I'm not aware. I don't know the specific answer to that question, Your Honor. I'm not aware that that Boyle really is for juries to be deciding fact issues like this. I think part of the Boyle Doctrine is to protect the government's discretion from being tried in court. And so I think that that's one piece of it. But I think going back to your question, Judge Southwick, about the blade land machines, and there's two different components to this case. There's acceptance and use, and whether there was conformance, and whether there's the government approving, based on its oversight and acceptance, the conformance, and then there's the nonconformance. I know there's been a lot of discussion about the nonconformance evidence, and I want to talk about that with respect to the blade land diameters in particular, because the only evidence that plaintiffs have on that is the ipsy-dixit testimony of two experts, Pekowski and Cardin. Both of their opinions rest entirely on Cardin's analysis of the post-crash 2023 analysis of the blade lands. And we think that is entirely non-probative. That's exactly the kind of testimony that this court has recognized as conclusory, unsubstantiated, and non-probative. And there's two big reasons for that. One is simply because it's a 2023 look at a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the compressor after 7 years where the compressor was heavily used, part of an unfortunate and tragic crash, deformed in fire, disassembled by the government, and sitting for years in storage, zip-tied. That's what Cardin is looking at in 2023 and opining on what the condition of a 2016 compressor is. Because the question for this court, for the courts on conformance, is did Standard Aero's work conform in 2016? That enormous disconnect between the 2023 look and the 2016 with all those intervening events makes that testimony entirely non-probative. That's reason one. Reason two.
Well, before you leave reason one, it seems to me, unless there's evidence that the crash itself could have caused some reaction within this particular unit that would cause these rubs on the side that were not circular, they're not 360, but were off-center and show that perhaps the core of the unit was not properly placed. Unless there's some evidence that the crash itself could have caused shifting or whatever that resulted in that evidence, it does seem to me to raise a fact question.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I think that it's his obligation to show that it might have, that it doesn't have to rule out those sorts.
Well, I don't know what all evidence you know what it is, but it seems to me their argument is that in the briefing, at least, that the crash could not have caused that it had to be from the operation of the engine. And I don't know what the evidence supported. You typically tell me there's no evidence to suggest that. certainly will be looking at that.
Well, and there is evidence in the record, and I point the court to the factual teardown report that the government did, and that's in the sealed portion of our record at docket 112-1, page one, PDF page 179, that, and there's other, I believe, as well, that talks about the isolated blade tip rubbing as being normal. And part of that goes to how, after the machining of the blade lands are the tracks where the blades go through, right? And so the first time that the engine is run, there is a fit that is made as the blade diffs go through the land because there's extra aluminum. So the blade tip rubbing is normal. There is evidence on that. I obviously don't want to get into a factual dispute about where it was, but I do think that with some evidence that it's normal, it undermines the probativeness of his measurements taken in 2023 when we all know what happened in the interim between 2017 and 2023.
Of course, anything that just creates a dispute doesn't help you.
We think it falls under the line of even being probative evidence for that reason. The second important reason, though, is even if you put that to the side, Cardin also wrongly applied a different methodology, and this independently makes his measurements non-probative, and plaintiffs have no answer to this in their reply brief. We argued this in our brief, and they had nothing in response. The government's technical manuals are what dictates in 2016 how Standard Aero was supposed to measure the blade land diameters, and it was very clear that to do that, they had to have the compressor case assembled and bolted so it's torqued, because that's a very different fit before it's bolted and when it's disassembled. Cardin admitted that he looked at it disassembled, no bolts in, and not torqued. So it's an apples to oranges. It's non-probative for that reason. It's completely apples to oranges of his 2023 measurements compared to the 2016.
So on your first point, I don't know if you were in the briefing, you talk about the Dederman versus Boeing case, does that case suggest that using different test conditions can never create a fact issue under Boyle's second element?
I hesitate to say never, but certainly if you do it under different test conditions in this circumstance where you have a government specification that is requiring it in a certain way and a meaningful difference when you don't have that specification complied with or do have that specification complied with, our position is that is no evidence at all. It's the sort of it's no evidence. The measurements are no evidence, and then all the opinions and testimony that flows from that is therefore unsubstantiated, non-probative, and cannot get past summary judgment. Candidly, but also, and to step back a little bit, I'm not trying to get away from nonconformance. There's more to talk about there, but part of this you have to look that this is presented for this court is we have robust evidence of acceptance and use. And this court's case law is very well established in recognizing acceptance and use from, we've cited all the cases in our brief on that. And so what plaintiffs are trying to say is that all that you just throw away because they have some evidence of nonconformance. And with a gaping hole like that, where the measurements on which pretty much their entire nonconformance case relies, the court can at least look at that in the way it has in other case law, like this court's Miller decision, and this, in the Xerox case, and say that none of this evidence is sufficient to overcome the overwhelming case that the government itself has spoken on this issue through its close monitoring, through its government oversight and acceptance, and it has said that there is conformance on the facts of this case. And I really want to emphasize, from a legal and a policy perspective, it would gut the acceptance and use doctrine, and maybe Boyle itself certainly as a summary judgment, if this court is to hold that all it takes to get to a jury is for a plaintiff to attach an expert's opinion, saying there's nonconformance, and then critique the government's inspection process, which is all that we have here. The plaintiffs are attacking the government's inspection process, saying that they should have disassembled the compressor again, notwithstanding that they monitored the work live while it was disassembled. They engaged in process audits 24 to 28 in this year on the T56 compressor. They also had other, work records inspections in addition to the final inspection. If all a plaintiff has to do is get an expert to say they didn't do this also, and they should have disassembled this, it's going to lead to a situation where Boyle again can never be invoked, and would always an acceptance and use case will never work.
But the examination after the crash showed that the blades did not make a perfect circle. So how do you avoid that? The measurements were pretty specific.
And when you say not make, you mean in terms of where the blade land measurements or the blade disc measurements?
The blade that's supposed to be a perfect circle, but it wasn't. It was something off.
Right, and there's absolutely nothing to indicate that that is a cause of the crash. And I just want to be clear about that because there's been some discussion about the engine being the cause of the crash. The court has before it the factual findings from the government investigation report, the AAIB report, which found that there's no engine-specific condition. Let me quote, so I'm not misstating it. Did not identify an engine-specific condition that could explain the abnormal operational behavior. And that's at ROA 3055, and I'll talk about that. But to answer your question, in terms of the blade land diameters and the look after the crash, that's part of what goes to the non-probativeness of Cardin's measurements. It had been heavily used by that point in time, including the engine break-ins, which, as I mentioned, there's evidence showing that when the compressor is first used, when it's on an engine and on a plane, that is where the cutting can happen as it's in that test, and that changes the complexion. And so I think that there's a number of different things. And again, this goes back to what he was looking at. He was looking at the disassembled compressor that the government had long since disassembled since the investigation. He was not looking at the bolted and torqued compressor case, which is just fundamentally different. It's like apples and oranges in a true, true sense. And I want to talk also about the government's use of this plane, because it is extensive. And it isn't just the 35 hours of flight time that we've heard about compared to other numbers. In this case, you had in February 2017, number one, the military installed the compressor onto an engine. That's use. Then in July 2017, the military installed the engine and the compressor onto a plane. That's more use. In October 2017, the military tested the engine by conducting the engine run of its choosing, and that, based on that, found that the engine and the compressor passed and put it into service. And that shows both acceptance and use, because that's like a full test of the compressor and the engine, accepting it and continuing to use it. Then the military flew the plane 8 times over a 9-month period for over 35 hours of flight time. And importantly, that number doesn't include other time that the engine is running when it's not actual flight time. It doesn't include when the plane is taxiing. It doesn't include when the compressor and the engine are running while they're doing maintenance work. And we have in the record, for example, where the Prang maintainers were doing maintenance on a different component after the RPM issues on the earlier flights, including the ferry flight. The Prang maintainers were doing maintenance on a different component as part of the propeller system. During all that time, the engine and the compressor are running. And so this was extensive use in context and looking at cumulatively all of the totality of usage. And again, in this context where every use of the compressor and the engine is high stress use. Obviously, when the plane is flying several hundred miles per hour in the air, but also when the compressor is going 100% while the plane is on the ground doing other things. And this comparison to the minimum warrantied hours does not shed light on anything. No one would say that you're not extensively using your car because it's still under, you haven't extensively used your car because it's still under warranty. And so we think in this case too, the military's use of the airplane was extensive. And so that combined with the acceptance and use, and I want to go back to, again, the case law on this, because this court's law has been clear, and I'll just a couple of the cases. Miller v. Diamond Shamrock from this court said clearly that acceptance and use can establish conformance. This court's Zering decision said without qualifications that government contractor can, quote, prove an item, quote, conform to the government inspection specifications by showing acceptance and use of the item following its production. Full stop, no caveats. Not a suggestion that other evidence can come and defeat that. This is not merely an inference or a presumption. And in fact, I would urge the court to look also at In Re Air Disaster case that's cited in our briefs. Only acceptance and use related evidence was discussed under the second prong, and the court found it met. So this is not merely an inference or a rebuttable presumption. This is conclusive under this court's case law. And I want to go back to the reasons why that's important. Because if this court were to hold to the contrary, that attaching an expert report to say nonconformance and then citing a few things that the government could have done differently, that means that acceptance and use can never work at all, but also in the summary judgment context, it would be easy for anyone to get past. And I really think that that undermines the whole point of Boyle.
Let me make sure I understand what you say the whole point of Boyle is. Let's say the evidence was far from being a genuine dispute, that was absolutely undisputed, that during this maintenance, the assembly was not put back symmetrically, axis symmetric, and in fact the blades were a little bit too long. The evidence is uncontrovertible that that's the case. But everything else about the case is just the same. All the review at the time by the military inspectors, all the other things that you're telling us. Would the government, would this protection apply to the maintenance?
Yes, and there's a lot.
I think that's your point. I just want to make sure that is your point.
That's my point, and that's what this court said, for example, in Miller, and I would urge the court to look at footnote 5, page 442, footnote 5, because I think what Your Honor's describing is a situation where it's a latent defect, right? I mean, in your hypothetical, and I'm taking your word that everything's the same, but in your hypothetical, the contractor doesn't know those things. The contractor does not know those things are a problem, right? So it does not know
about it. The contractor has done something negligently but doesn't know it.
Correct.
Because it may not want to go
there. Because if it did know, then under prong 3, it has to tell the government. But prong 3 is not at issue here. So in that scenario, you're talking about a truly latent defect. And you're talking about, I suppose, an argument that the government's procedures just didn't catch it. And in footnote 5 in Miller, what this court said is latent defects, that it upholds Boyle's purpose to apply it in those circumstances. Because the government is the one that makes the discretionary choices about what level of inspection is needed, because it's balancing a lot of different factors. We're talking about the military here. And so the military has a lot of factors to balance that go beyond whether one more step would have been worth it in light of the importance of this type of the plane to the military. And I think that that's what this court explained, and it's quoting from Boyle, the key part of Boyle that talks about how the government generally, but especially the military, needs to have the ability to weigh these different factors and not be second-guessed in the way it is here about its discretionary choices, about whether it should have disassembled the module one last time. And I know I see that I'm out of time. There's more nonconformance evidence I'd be happy to address, but I don't want to overextend my time.
We have more cases behind you.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, just very briefly, Your Honors. To Judge Englehart, to your question about juries, there are plenty of cases in which the Boyle question has gone to a jury. It's an affirmative defense. Juries can be instructed. Indeed, I think the right answer here.
But is it an affirmative defense or an immunity?
It's a great question, Judge Englehart. So at least there's no case law in this court, but the en banc Fourth Circuit in the Al-Shamari case held that it's a defense, not an immunity, which mattered there for the purposes of whether a denial at the motion to dismiss stage was immediately appealable. The en banc Fourth Circuit said no. And my sense is that is the run of the case law out there. And so we would not object to the standard error preserving Boyle arguments, whether back on remand, if there's still anything left to their summary judgment motion, or before the jury. That's where we think this case should go. And to my friend's sort of suggestion that there's no case law, that this would basically, all it takes is having experts who go through the gauntlet of Daubert, who have provided detailed evidence that the district court doesn't discredit. I wouldn't downplay that. I think that's actually a pretty high burden that has been hard to overcome, as it should be, in many of the cases that have been cited to this court. But we cite cases to the contrary. So in our opening brief at pages 34 and 35, Your Honors have in front of you cases where acceptance and use was not enough. That's all that matters here, right? It is not conclusive. Will there be cases in which it is sufficient? Of course, that's as it should be, where the plaintiffs have not adduced direct evidence to the contrary. That's just not this case. Judge Southwick, very briefly, to our colloquy from before about the shop order measurements, one point I neglected to make in my opening is it's worth stressing that what's in the record is that even if we accept that there might have been contemporaneous measurements by Standard Aero, those measurements were conducted with a handheld analog micrometer. Your Honors, that's basically like using a ruler. And so again, back to the material question of fact as to whether those measurements even happened. It's hard to believe that a ruler could produce accurate measurements along so many variables to that specificity. Again, not to prove it didn't, Judge Southwick, just to prove that it's a question of fact. On the question of Mr. Cardin and his test methods, I'll just say there is record testimony from Mr. Cardin that had he followed the exact same procedures, it wouldn't have made a difference. And so, Judge Engelhardt, to your exchange with opposing counsel, we don't think the cases say it's conclusive if the methods are inconsistent, but we also have testimony in the district court that the methods of measurement in this case would not have produced a different result. Finally, on the question of the axis of symmetry, you heard opposing counsel say blade rub is normal. Of course it is. Isolated blade rub is what's abnormal. And so Standard Aero's repeated efforts to rely on the government report, which are precluded by statute, which Standard Aero still hasn't mentioned, again, go back to the question of a question of material fact. The ultimate question, Your Honors, is did the government make Standard Aero do what the plaintiffs allege they did negligently? And the evidence as it reaches this court is that it did not. And that's why Boyle, at least at this stage, should not have supported summary judgment and why we believe a reversal and remand is the appropriate relief. Thank you very much.
Thanks to both of you for your presentations this morning. It's been helpful. Keep going.